listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we speak with Margaret Kimberly, who's a columnist with BlackAgendaReport.com, with a weekly column entitled Freedom Rider. Her column last week was entitled Contradictions of White Supremacy, and it begins with a discussion of the profiling in the New York Times of an Ohio Nazi. Kimberly discussed the kid glove approach taken by the Times, which was characterized as too obvious, and discusses the reaction of readers and what it means in the larger context of white supremacy in the United States. We spoke with her via Skype Thursday. Let's talk about white supremacy, which means let's talk about something going on in America and the contradictions, which they don't get talked about much.
No, they don't. I was moved to write this article because of a brouhaha in the New York Times. A reporter interviewed a man who is a overt proclaimed white supremacist in Ohio. A man with who can be called a Nazi. He has Nazi memorabilia and so forth. And they gave him the floor, basically, in this interview. No pushback, no nothing. And readers were outraged about this, and I believe that they should have been, but it raised a couple of issues for me. One, this was not the first puff piece about a white supremacist in American media. Richard Spencer, when he was first introduced to the public, it was like he was a new celebrity. Yeah. People talked about his good looks and all kinds of things. It was quite telling to me. And the fact that people are fascinated by them, I don't think there's that much to say. There are a lot of people who are racist. We live in a very racist country, and there are many people who are avowed racists. I don't think that's something that needs to be personalized in the way that the media have done. But at any rate, in this New York Times article, they had to backtrack. They changed the article title. People were writing in. And I thought about a couple of things. The fact that they did this article at all, but also some of the frankly phony outrage that came from New York Times readers and other people who would be aghast if you told them they were racist or that they benefit from white supremacy when they do every day. So I raised the issue, for example, here in New York, all these New Yorkers writing to the New York Times and clutching their pearls about coverage of a white nationalist.
Right.
When we had, when it was at its height, at its worst, stop and frisk, when Bloomberg was mayor of New York City, and black people in particular were being stopped and harassed by the police. And there were actually arrest quotas in New York. I mean, most places there's a quota for writing parking tickets or something, but there was extreme pressure on the police to make arrests. And who do you think that impacted?
Yeah.
But every indication, white New Yorkers thought that was just fine. Every poll showed that most white people thought that was fine.
You know, not for nothing. The New York Times, by the way, was referring to like black teenagers as wolf packs and all kinds. You know, this whole they were animalizing black people in the New York Times in the very pages that they're complaining about this now.
Absolutely, they were. And but if you asked someone, if you confronted someone who thought that those policies were fine, and said, well, that makes you a white supremacist, they would, most of them, I think, would have argued against it. So my first point was that, you know, people can't, we can't let Trump let racism get out of jail free card,
right,
as I say, where if you're not a Nazi, if you're not a white supremacist, you are allowed to live your life without being confronted about the variety of ways in which, as a white person, one has a variety of advantages.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I could go on. You know, people who would not didn't complain about stop and frisk, people who say nothing about mass incarceration, they either don't care or they think it's a good idea for as many mm-hmm. black people as possible to be locked away. People who gentrify. My neighborhood here in Harlem, I've lived here for about 30 years, and I'd say for 20 of those years, there were hardly any white people. Now, every
right.
new person who moves in is white, and that's creating displacement.
Right.
And that is racism. That is white supremacy.
Yep.
So, but it's never called that. And so that's an easy out. It's like shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, I mean, very
to
few
point fingers
yeah, I know,
at
I know.
A guy who right. has Nazi memorabilia.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's supposed to, in other words, this normal racism that exists in the country, in other words, the normalized racism that exists, is sort of not covered. Here is an example of not normalized racism, and that personifies all racism. So see those 12 guys over there? They're the racists. The rest of you folks over here, you're fine.
Yeah, yeah, you're good. You know, and you didn't vote for Trump,
right?
And you voted for Hillary, and
right.
so you're okay. Well, I'm saying no, you're not.
Yeah,
not necessarily.
I mean, you mentioned mass incarceration, for example, and then you mentioned Hillary. That's one of the first things that popped in my head. Of course, when we go back to Bill Clinton's administration and the various federal bills that both increased the federal prison population and modeled for the state increases that followed.
Yes, and she, of course, supported it and referred to
sold
black
them.
Teens as, was it, super predators?
Super predators,
who have to
yeah.
be brought to heel like
yeah.
like dogs.
Yep, right.
And speaking of animalizing human
yeah, right.
beings.
Yeah, exactly, yep.
So, so she was in the forefront of something which decimated the black community and is still decimating us for in a variety of ways. And yet, because of this political system we have, this duopoly, which does not allow for any other voices to be heard, we have these two parties, which are allegedly polar opposites, but not really. And most black people cling to the Democratic Party, to try to fight against the Republican Party, which for the last 50 years or so has been the white people's party. So we desperately cling to this party in order to fight the one that is worse in some ways.
Right.
But in fact, it's just like a kabuki theater of who's who's really
exactly.
worse.
Right.
But because it doesn't matter who's in the White House, the prison population doesn't go down.
Right.
It doesn't matter who's in the White House. Police still have the right to kill with impunity.
Right.
So there's arguing around the margins of what is considered acceptable discourse in this country.
Right.
So so here we are giving our votes. To these people who don't do any more for us, and in fact can be more harmful because they have the cover of being Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, this goes really to the heart of the question of identity politics versus revolutionary politics. So form versus essence, symbology as opposed to, you know, the material. You have the New York Times propping up symbols of racism, and so people don't see the actual racism, which is, in, you know, it's right in front of them in their daily lives, but nobody, that's not part of the public discourse. You have, you know, a variety of different, look at the one of the primary examples of the expression of white supremacy that's taken place in the last 50 years, maybe, the recolonization of Africa.
Yes.
But that takes place at the hands of a black president, so it's not racist. It's not white supremacy. It's something else. I mean, in other words, the symbology blurs the material. And then so you have, you know, on the one hand, real racists hiding behind some knucklehead, you know, with a Nazi uniform in Ohio.
Right.
And you have real white supremacist, you know, imperial foreign policy hiding behind a black president.
Well, if you yes, and then another excellent example is Libya.
Right.
Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton destroyed Libya.
Right.
And empowered these. Now Libya, there is no Libyan state as such anymore. There are several factions, rival factions, fighting over that territory. And now we see the literal enslavement of migrants from other African countries.
Yeah, after the lynchings that were at the beginning that were incited essentially by the CIA, which was operating under Obama.
It all happened under Obama. All black towns, such as a city called Tuwerga, were literally reduced to rubble.
Incinerated.
Yes, they were. Dark-skinned Libyans and African migrants were targeted for mass murder. And all of this happened because of Obama and Clinton.
Right.
Now it's in the news again because there is some footage of these slave auctions actually taking place. There are stories of people having their organs harvested. And that's has something to do, organ trafficking. Israel is the number one country involved in that. That's been documented many times. But now everyone's in an uproar. But nobody wants to mention Obama and Clinton and their role in making this happen. Yes, NATO was involved, but the rest of NATO doesn't act unless the United States gives the go-ahead.
That's right.
And Hillary Clinton and the then UK Prime Minister Cameron and who was France at the time, Sarkozy, all showed up personally in Libya to dance on Gaddafi's grave, so to speak, and to brag about having committed this war crime. That's all it can be called.
Well, Sarkozy,
so now people want to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, Sarkozy, you know, did a little advance dance over in Cote d'Ivoire, by the way, when he sent the French troops in to pull Gbagbo out of the presidential palace at gunpoint. And the U.S. sent them there because the first onslaught into Libya was reported in a Pakistan Observer in February of 2011, U.S., U.K., and French troops landed in East Europe on troop transport.
Yes.
Joint project.
But now that this story of enslavement is in the news, many reporters won't even mention Obama and Clinton by name.
I know.
I have called people to task. I have gone on Twitter. I have emailed people, and I have asked them, how do you write about the destruction of Libya and not mention the names Obama and Clinton?
Right.
And then some people are like, can we blame them? You know, there is, but it's still like very, very weak. and talk about excuse me, color supremacy. My God, but that is something they are directly responsible for having carried out. And the New York Times never, ever covered this, ever.
Nope.
At any rate, so that's another example of the blatant white supremacy, that this happened because of the black president of the United States gave the go-ahead. It would not have happened absent Barack Obama and people. Now he's trying to say he made a mistake in Libya because he didn't plan for the aftermath. And I'm sick and tired of these aggressions. Yeah, these aggressions being called mistakes. Iraq was a mistake. Libya was a mistake. Interventions are war crimes.
Yeah.
And American liberals need to stop. They need to call. They are war crimes. They need to be referred to as such. And of course, they're always covered with. In Libya, it was supposed to be a humanitarian intervention. Mm. So they made up lies with the help of Human Rights Watch and the International Criminal Court, the ICC, saying that Gaddafi's troops had been given Viagra and they were all going to go on a raping spree. And these are the kinds of things that were lies that were used to justify the destruction of this country. Mm-hmm. So, and that's also a kind of white supremacy, the worst kind, actually, where people, a nation was destroyed, people have been killed, people are being killed, people are suffering now because of this country, because of a democratic president who's now being held up as some paragon of virtue because he has better manners than Donald Trump does.
Mm. Yeah, there's really low-hanging fruit, too.
Yes, it is.
You know, you've got not just the, you know, the excuse that it was a mistake. In the case of Libya, all right, we had heard in the case of Iraq about the list of the countries that we got from, Clinton's old Joint Chiefs of Staff head. I can't remember the general's name at the moment, but there was the list of Iraq, Iran, you know, yada, 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 that were all, you know, being targeted for regime change. And so we could see the pattern there, those of us that were, you know, paying any attention. But what list we haven't seen is the one where Libya is the gateway to Africa, because you had the French go into Cote d'Ivoire, and about 2 seconds after the U.S. started taking down Libya, they went into Mali and a bunch of other countries that were formerly, quote-unquote, French Africa. And you had, in the background, through the Bush administration, they were, you know, rumbling that they needed to revive SOUTHCOM and create AFRICOM. And then they actually established AFRICOM legally in October of 2008. In other words, while they were supposed to be busy trying to save the economy because it had tanked and they were, you know, giving the banks trillions of dollars and, you know, all of that, they open up in Stuttgart, Germany, the offices of the African Command of the U.S. military, because no country on the African continent would host them, even though there's all this money that goes with it. You know, even though there's all kinds of economic benefits, you know, for the moment of, you know, you have here a few thousand people that are going to be buying steaks and cars and whatever from local, you know, folks. Despite all of that, everybody said, hell no. And the main impediment to the U.S. reentering was Libya, who had had the last U.S. military troops in 1969, right after the revolution in 69. Libya, Gaddafi evicted them, and that was the last U.S. troops on the African continent with a permanent base. So after they take down Libya, suddenly AFRICOM is installed in 35 African countries and is operating now as, in essence, the command and control for almost all of the militaries on the African continent. What a mistake. They just slipped into, oops, what a boo-boo.
Yes. And so, but they're allowed to get away with these lies because there is not an understanding of, or I guess an acknowledgement of, U.S. imperialism. And because we have these and I was just thinking of the word, is a very juvenile understanding of politics in this country, where one side of the duopoly is bad, 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 evil. The other side, we have to rejoice if they're in power. But in fact, it's like a tag team. It's like professional wrestling. I mean, many, many people have said that. It's like there's a phony villain and a phony hero, but the whole thing is phony. And so one side gets to be presented as being evil and horrible. The other side gets to be presented as being good. There's no alternative. Anybody who dares suggest that we seek out an alternative is called a supporter of the evil, bad people. And so it goes on and on and on, where so now you have some cracker in Ohio being profiled in the New York Times. And yes, it's a puff piece, and, and no, it should not have been. But he gets to stand for all racism in the country as it is practiced. And other people get to pat themselves on the back, people who support horrible things otherwise, some because they're not aware. And I always have to remind myself how the role the media play in just in not telling people things. It's interesting to me. ISIS is out of Syria, for example. Have you seen that in the New York Times?
Yeah, not at all. Nope.
ISIS was supposed to be evil, but it, of course, ISIS was doing America's work for it in attacking the secular Arab regimes. And Putin helped Assad to get ISIS out of Syria. So now you can't, they won't tell you that ISIS has been defeated in Syria. ISIS has been defeated in Iraq. And so that goes unmentioned. So I think about, I'm digressing a little bit, but all of the things that are just kept from us, the lies of omission that are just inconvenient. So they are not allowed in the pages of the newspaper. And so people get to have these views about goodness and badness and racism and not racism that are based on lies or on trivialities.
Like artificial parameters. I mean, for example, I don't know how many people this character represents out in Ohio, okay? He gets profiled and is the center of controversy, and we're even speaking about him now just because it's a thing, you know? However, not Glenn Ford, Bruce Dixon, Margaret Kimberly, Danny Haifong, Ajamu Baraka, mentioned, except for Ajamu, because he actually ran for vice president. Maybe they mentioned him twice. New York Times never mentioned. I'm looking at blackagendaradio.podbean.com, where the Black Agenda Radio program is hosted. It's a server that radio stations use to download it. 1.794 million downloads. Okay? How many downloads do you think Homeboy out in Ohio has on his little blog page? What, 50, 100, 250, 1,000? And he gets profiled, Black Agenda who? At the New York Times.
Well, that, you know, and that was my other, and I'm one of the people who wrote to the Times, and I said, can you ever find a leftist to profile? And I added, I said, and I didn't say Democrat, I said leftist.
That's right, big difference.
They use these people to gin up hysteria, to help their readers feel superior. And I have not even of the Green Party. I've never seen a profile of a Green Party voter or candidate in the New York Times. Maybe I missed it. I mean, it could have been in there. But that would give legitimacy to people being opposed to the system. That would give legitimacy to people questioning the manufactured consent. So that is something that's forbidden. But they'll reach out to this guy and cause a big drama that's also phony.
Well, let's go back to Crossfire on CNN, for example, which was the debate program that they had. It still is, I guess. I think they still use it. The left, quote unquote, you had Tom Brady. Okay, yes. And on the right, you had, I forgot his name, that was in the Nixon administration. He's a kind of a wild man, right-winger. But Tom Brady.
Buchanan.
Yeah, Pat Buchanan, right. And actually, he doesn't get much airtime anymore because he's actually sort of an oppositionist, you know, more than sort of. He's an oppositionist. He's outside the framework of, you know, official opposition now. But Tom Brady, the leftist, was a CIA official.
Yes.
And his biggest legacy was that he wrote Eight is Enough, the book. He's the author of that. While he was in the CIA, he wrote about his family life, and Eight is Enough came out of that. He represented the left throughout the 80s. Yes. When Reagan was threatening World War III, he was representing us.
Yes, we were told. Yes, exactly. And that's what we get. And people who really are on the left have to be disappeared. And now, of course, they are using Russiagate as an excuse to further disappear. Right. The internet leveled the playing field a little bit, and mm-hmm. that we all had the ability to seek out new sources of information.
Yep.
So now, under the guise of fighting Vladimir Putin, they've changed the algorithms on Google. So, and I've seen this myself, try to search for articles by name that I wrote in Black Agenda.
Yeah, right. You can't find your own stuff in Google.
It's disappeared. And they admitted that they're doing this. And this is supposed to be to fight the foreign interference from the evil Russians.
Right.
And this is being used to make certain that we don't have a voice at all, that the one vehicle we have been able to use to change discourse, to give new information, to make sure that is disappeared altogether. They're trying to disappear RT and Sputnik altogether. They had to register as foreign agents. They took, Congress took RT's press, it's not a pass, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the term, credentials, I'm still blanking on the term, but at any rate, so they have been silenced too.
Yep, and let alone lesser quote-unquote voices, I don't know the last time I saw Telesur, for example, mentioned at all, and frankly, I don't think they're all that radical with the exception of their coverage of Venezuela. And yet it's, you know, head and shoulders outside of the, you know, parameters of what the New York Times will cover. Go to the New York Times, you know, world page for the Americas. You would think once in a while this Latin America-based English language media source would be a source of a report once a year. And I've never seen it. So, you know, the complete universe, Press TV. When they report mm-hmm. on Iran. I mean, we've been dealing with Iran in the media since at least, if not 1953, 1979. I don't think I've seen the New York Times refer to Press TV once, except when they were beaten up on them for something, I forget, 5-6 years ago that happened, one occasion. That was it. Instead of normally, this is what they say in Tehran on Press TV, this is what they say in Saudi Arabia on Al Arabiya. You know, they don't do that at all.
No, they don't. And when Trump announced a couple of days ago that he would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, you would think that some Palestinians would be interviewed.
Right.
And, of course, that's not what happened. Ali Abunima from Electronic Intifada said he was interviewed by Russia television, and he was on TV in the UK and some other place. No calls from any American corporate media. So they were, the Palestinians were disappeared, as if that this discussion has nothing to do with them.
Their defender, quote unquote, who really was only defending them to the extent he could attack Trump, was Wolf Blitzer, who worked for AIPAC and was a reporter for the Jerusalem Post. That was the coverage from the Palestinian side on CNN.
He was representing Palestine.
Yep.
But those are things that Americans, it's frightening to me the degree to which this media that's so all pervasive that it lies to people and spins a whole tale with, you know, sometimes we have to choose a date, Don, to talk about Russiagate.
Yeah.
And the various ways in which it's used to excuse the Democrats' defeat to Trump, to make the case literally for war, So it is a tremendous, tremendous lie. And they do it. It's very simple, really. They do it by repetition. You just repeat the same things over and over and over again and make sure that a counter argument is never allowed to see the light of day.
That's right.
And you can convince people that and everything bad happening in the world is Vladimir Putin's fault. And the United States has never done anything bad anywhere in the world. That should be a topic for another day.
I mean, all you need to do is interview anybody anywhere else in the world, and they'll give you the lowdown on that. But, you know, all right, you close it with, the open white supremacist cannot be the determining factor of how we pursue political action. Amen to that. And then that the same is true of faux outrage from the white liberals, which cannot be trusted either.
No, it cannot. But it just shows you the precarious nature and the failure of black politics, the fact that we don't have black politics anymore, that we allow these trivial matters. I'm not saying racism is trivial, but people being worked up over coverage of a racist guy in Ohio, to allow that to be the determining factor of how we organize, or frankly, not talking about asking the question of how we organize and how we practice self-determination, so that we're not fooled anymore, we're not jerked around by phony issues, and that we give ourselves permission to critique people who think they're on our side or pretend to be on our side because they can't stomach the fact that some Trump supporter in Nowheresville was given a profile in the New York Times.
Margaret Kimberly has a weekly column at blackagendareport.com under the banner Freedom Rider. We've been talking about her article last week entitled Contradictions of White Supremacy, and thank you very much. We definitely need to speak some more about some of the things you mentioned. Margaret, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Donald Trump is making history again, this time in the Middle East. Russia is banned from the 2018 Winter Olympics. Is this politics on steroids? And do neocons and Mikhail Saakashvili have no shame? Cross-talking some real news, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Alex Christofora. He's the director and writer for the Duran.com. And we have Victor Olevich. He is a political analyst as well as a leading expert at the Center for Actual Politics. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. The ricochet effect of Donald Trump recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel continues, and we all expected that here. Mark, I understand you've been mining the pearls of wisdom coming from that woman that has a PhD in hillbilly studies, Nikki Haley, at the United Nations.
I have to say that this stand-up comedian that the U.S. has sent to the Security Council is even funnier than the last one. Although I know she's largely taking her crib notes, she's got some zingers that she's extemporaneously added.
Provide us some zingers here.
All right. So, Nikki Haley, the U.S. has done much more to the U.N., I'm sorry, has done much more to damage the prospects for Middle East peace than to advance them. We will not be a party to that. The U.S. no longer stands by when Israel is unfairly attacked in the United Nations. When has the U.S. ever stood by? Well, and the United States will not be lectured to by countries that lack any credibility when it comes to treating both Israelis.
Lack of credibility. I think those are the key words.
So I guess the U.S. is not going to lecture itself, being as the one that it's lacks the most credibility when it comes to mediating between Israel
and Palestinians. Transparent here is that, you know, there was the Security Council was called an emergency meeting. Everyone discussed it, and we had one country, one ambassador to the United Nations defending it. I mean, it's been roundly criticized, as we all expected it would be.
It is very, very rare that an American president makes a decision that has absolutely no benefit for his own country. And this is exactly such a decision. This decision is not beneficial to the United States. In fact, it's very detrimental to the U.S. diplomacy in the Middle East and to the U.S. position in the Middle East and overall in the world.
I think you can even go further, Alex. I think, you know, when allies are put into a precarious position, I mean, like it or not, the United States and Israel are close allies here, but Trump is actually endangering Israel in much the same way that the American ally in Asia, South Korea, is being threatened because, you know, Donald Trump is making a decision over their heads, as it were, and really defining what their security interests are, which they're not aligned, as Donald Trump seems to understand how the world works.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he set the Middle East on fire with this announcement, and I just can't imagine how they're going to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem without billions and billions of dollars in security. And I mean, it's just going to be a complete mess. It's going to be a complete mess. But more than that, I think we should focus on Trump's decision, that it was very much a populist decision. We may all criticize it, but when you look at the mainstream media and you look at a lot of the U.S. population, they're for this decision. They may not know the nuances around
this. I was going to say, they don't understand the geopolitical issues.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. But when you look at even Obama, even Clinton, they were for moving the embassy to Jerusalem. They just didn't have the guts to do it. And here comes Trump, who just comes in and says, let's do it. And so, I mean, people in general, the U.S., the public, and a lot of the high political class in the mainstream media are behind this decision, and they've expressed that they're behind the decision.
I would say something about why Clinton and Bush and so forth, who made promises of moving the embassy and didn't do it. They weighed the pros and cons and decided not to do it based on
That's why they had that waiver. It was a get-out-of-jail-free card.
But why did they make those promises? They wanted to please the Israeli lobby in Washington, but at the same time not make detrimental decisions to the decisions that are detrimental to the U.S. foreign policy. But what does this decision say about Washington today? It says a lot about the rising influence of the Israeli lobby in D.C. This is the first and foremost reason why this decision was made now. There's also
There's another lobby that's up and coming there, and it's the Saudi one here. How does this work, Mark, here? Because, I mean, rhetorically, of course, the Saudis have come out against this, okay? I'm not sure they're actually committed to it, and maybe this is all part of Jared Kushner's big plan for peace in the Middle East, which we know nothing about.
Yeah, no, I think this is just the Trump administration stepping over its own feet and managing to unite the entirety of the world outside of the U.S. and Israel against it, even in this case, Saudi Arabia, even if mostly rhetorically. Now, I'm going to borrow from both Victor and from the U.S. government officials' own playbook. They love to lecture other countries, officials from other countries, that what they do is not in the interests of their own people. Well, this move is not in the interests of the American people, but it is in the interests of Donald J. Trump. And this is
and
why this
maybe,
was done.
Maybe Bibi Netanyahu, because he's in political hot water right now.
I've got, if you'll bear with me here, Trump's 12 steps, why this was done. All right? So, Trump, one, it distracts the mainstream media from the Russiagate witch hunt. Two, it placates and pleases the foreign policy elite on both sides of the aisle. Remember, Chuck Schumer, the Democratic minority leader in the Senate, encouraged Trump to do that, and he's quite proud about that. Number three, it plays to Trump's domestic base. Number four, it finally ends the longstanding fiction of the U.S. as a neutral Middle East peace mediator. Number five, it forces the Arab regimes to remember Palestine. They'd all rather forget.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, really?
Number six, it benefits Russia at the end of the day as the whole world looks aghast at the U.S. Number seven, it fulfills Obama's campaign declaration that Jerusalem is the undivided capital of Israel. I'm old enough to remember when Obama declared that during his campaign. Number eight, it has the neocons ready to declare him the second coming. Number nine, it has at least some potential to make the fragile Palestinian political reunification a reality. Number 10, it's pretty much sure to restart a new intifada. 11, it will result in the deaths of many Israelis, Lebanese, and even more Palestinians. And last but not least, it even further destabilizes the Middle East and North Africa powder keg, just like everything else the U.S. does in the region.
Okay. Thank you for that comprehensive list there, Mark. Let's talk about the Russia being banned from the 2018 Olympics in South Korea. In my introduction, I said, is this poisonous politics on steroids?
This is politics at its worst. It's a combination of, it's an injection of crude politics into sports, into international sports. It's very obvious that the Russian team being banned from the Olympics in South Korea has everything to do with the new Cold War being waged by the United States and its allies against Moscow, and very little to do with the actual doping scandals. Let's go back to the early 1980s. You know, in 1980, Washington and its allies, actually more than 50 countries, boycotted the Olympics in Moscow. But back then, they were more honest. They didn't talk about doping or any other reasons. They honestly said
it was politics.
The reason is political. They didn't like that the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan, and they didn't like that Moscow was challenging the U.S. somewhere, wouldn't listen to American orders, and they boycotted the Olympics. In 4 years in L.A., Moscow did the same with its allies and boycotted the Olympics in the U.S. And then the Cold War ended, and for about two decades, the Olympics went on fine. But then a new Cold War erupted, and we see this again.
Yeah, but it seems to me, Alex, this is like desperation. It's throw in sports right now, okay, to isolate Russia. I mean, I'm not an expert on this doping scandal, if it's real or not. But for me, when I think of the Winter Olympic Games, I can't think of it without one of the Winter Games superpowers, Russia, being there. It changes the dynamic completely.
Yeah, well,
all for politics.
No, politics has changed the dynamic completely, and I think politics has found a way to destroy just about every institution and organization that we once thought was maybe neutral, or was about peace, or was, you know, a fair playing field. It's not, and I think that's kind of what sums up the Trump presidency to me. Is even with Jerusalem, even with Hollywood now and the sexual abuse scandals, even with the Olympics, all the masks are off. We're starting to see everything very transparently. And with the Olympics, anyone that thought the Olympics was not about politics, was not about doping, that the athletes were not doping, all the athletes were doping, is a fool. We know that the athletes are doping. Look at Tyson Gay. Look at Justin Gatlin. Carl Lewis. Marion Jones. The U.S. had Balco in Silicon Valley feeding drugs to every single athlete. Olympics, baseball players, football players, everyone was busted, from Barry Bonds to Mark McGuire to all of them were busted doping.
But
nothing happened.
But the media will tell you that Russians are genetically prone to doping. That's what you get.
Well, the media are just quoting James Clapper, the former U.S. Director of National Intelligence, who said Russians are genetically predisposed towards deceit.
Can you imagine that statement being made against about any other ethnic group in the U.S. and what would happen to an official?
It's different for Russians because Russophobia is the new anti-Semitism.
Exactly.
Right. But let's be clear here. There was doping in Russia, like there is in most countries, right? There is evidence of that. But this politicized move to ban Russia from the Olympics.
Why isn't it? Common sense would be if an individual is caught doping, that person should be banned or put on some kind of timeline to get back in. Why is it an entire country?
Because of geopolitics, of course. Because the U.S. is angry at Syria and the U.S. And blocking the U.S.'s push from seizing control of at least all of Ukraine. But this is very specific. This is all based on a report by this kind of security contractor agency, the World Anti-Doping Agency, which farmed out its report to one Canadian lawyer who based all of his report on the testimony
of a... I'm going to jump in here. It sounds like we're talking about another fake dossier.
It's a special operation.
Hey, gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World
from CPR.
Okay, gentlemen, let's turn our attention to some recent events with Yemen. We just recently we had President Trump asking through intermediaries the Saudis to break the blockade of Yemen. As far as we know, UN agencies report that that hasn't happened. What's is this just optics here, or because I mean, you know, I think some of our viewers saw this really. Lack of responsibility from CBS on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago, whitewashing America's role in that probably the worst man-made humanitarian disaster in the world today.
Look, it's obviously media optics at play. Remember the Obama administration reaction to a bombing of a funeral procession in Yemen a couple years ago, when the White House essentially said that they're going to look over the cooperation and the military cooperation between Washington and Riyadh and see how they can influence Saudi Arabia to stop or to modify the brutality of its campaign against Yemen. Well, where did that go? Nowhere. Why? And we see the same thing happening today. The United States supports Saudi Arabia and its allies in their fight against Houthis in Yemen. The United States government knows full well what is happening in Yemen, something that is close to genocide, really. Mass hunger, mass killings.
Return of diseases
exactly.
That they thought were completely
wiped out. And the blockade, you know, when the United States wants its allies to do or not do something, it calls them and it tells them what to do or not to do, and usually it has an effect.
It's really interesting, Alex, is that we had Tillerson come out in the last few days essentially telling the Saudis they should be more thoughtful about how they behave in the Middle East.
When they're invading Yemen.
Yeah, exactly. I'd like to see the entire transcript, but when I read that line, I was really kind of taken aback. I mean, about the degree of this tragedy going on in Yemen and having that kind of rhetoric come out of the Secretary of State.
Yeah, I think it was complete optics. I think you're right. I think Trump made that announcement moments after he made the announcement about Jerusalem. And I don't know what was going through his communication team's mind when he made that announcement. I think he made it knowing that they're not going to push Saudi Arabia to pull back their assault.
So it's just kind of like, check,
kind of throwing the Arab world a bone after he just made a bombshell announcement about Jerusalem.
Nobody bought it.
Yeah,
really.
Nobody bought
it's
it. And I don't think anyone expects, you know, Saudi Arabia to pull back whatsoever.
Okay, another thing, let's change gears here. We have to cover so much here. We had the Russian Federation acting as an intermediary for North Korea, telling the U.S. that the North Koreans are interested in direct talks with the United States. I bet you didn't hear that in mainstream media. It's very it's very interesting considering the saber rattling that we have in media every time something happens in North Korea.
Well, we also have the dueling bombastic statements between Trump's Twitter feed and Kim Jong-un through his state media representatives insulting each other back and forth. But there are serious people starting to be worried about, how tense things have got in this situation. And that is revealed by discussion through select national security reporters in the mainstream media this week that have pointed out that whatever our politicians, Trump and many others before him and right now, have tried to present the North Korean leadership, including Kim Jong-un, as a madman, as insane, you know, like Trump himself, that is being now dismissed by the CIA and the Pentagon's own assessment, which is now being brought forward and highlighted, that they say that he is a rational actor acting in his country's national security interests, and that he intends to use a nuclear weapon only as a deterrent to protect his regime.
On Crosslink, we've done the North Korean programs for years, and I said to him, the director of the program said, every time we do it, it's the same program, because the demands that the North Koreans have always are the same. They want security guaranteed.
They want peace.
Stop. peace.
Look, as far as negotiations, let's remember what the North Korean approach was when Trump became president. They were ready to come. A North Korean delegation was ready to come to Washington and hold direct negotiations with State Department representatives. There were even visas almost issued to the North Koreans. But then at the last moment, the visas were invalidated, and the North Korean-American negotiations never came through. Now, just in the last several months, there was a report that essentially the United States transmitted a message to Pyongyang saying that if North Korea holds off making any new missile tests, conducting any new missile firings for 2 months, then the United States would go into a negotiating mode. Well, North Korea, actually, if you notice, before the last batch of missiles went off, it held off for 2 months
exactly.
And a week. And then they understood that the United States has not kept its word again.
You know, but one of the things I think is interesting is that the Russian angle on all this. I think, believe it or not, the Russians are trying to convince the Americans, you better wake up. There's still time before a collision, because we have two leaders that are spoiling for some kind of fight for PR. And I think Trump has foolishly got himself into a mess. He's painting himself into a corner.
And I agree with what Mark said earlier. I think you're starting to see some pockets of the mainstream media start to recognize that Korea, that North Korea, is acting in a very sane manner. I mean, you had Tucker Carlson do a 5-minute segment on North Korea where he admitted that a lot of what North Korea is doing can be attributed to what Hillary Clinton, the Obama team, did to Libya, or what happened to Saddam, in that the minute you get rid of your weapons, we're coming after you. You had Pat Buchanan write a piece about how North Korea is acting and that they are acting in a very predictable and very sane manner. So you are starting to see pockets of the media starting to speak out and say, wait a minute, not everything is as it's being presented here.
You know, Mark, Mikhail Saakashvili, former president of Georgia.
The fugitive from justice.
Well, there's a lot of other things in part of his title here. He's in the news again. Why?
Yeah, well, after being deposed by his own people, this U.S.-backed neoliberal strongman, he was briefly a hipster for a while, floating around Williamsburg. And then when the putsch regime backed by the West seized power in Ukraine, he was brought in to be the proconsul of Odessa, a Russian-majority city in southern, south-central
Ukraine. With the mandate to do what?
With the mandate, as hilarious as this is, to stop corruption, at least publicly, even though he's wanted on corruption and abusive charges, power charges in his own country. Well, he stepped on some wrong political toes in Ukraine, got a little bit of a big head, tried to imagine himself as prime minister of Ukraine, was removed from that. His Ukrainian citizenship was removed. He had renounced his Georgian citizenship in order to take Ukrainian citizenship. He is without state. He managed to force his way back into the Ukraine through the border against the wishes, at least, of the president.
And threatened to jump off of a building.
Look, his behavior is definitely bizarre. This isn't the first time he exhibits that kind of behavior. There were some issues with his tie, but that's a different story.
Yeah, CNN,
what's interesting?
That's right. Really good imitation, Mark. Okay.
So there's another interesting view of this from a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, Adrian Karatnitsky, who just a day ago wrote in his social media account, he protested that the U.S. taxpayers are actually paying for Saakashvili's activities in Ukraine and essentially funding the protesters that are protesting in his support in Kyiv. So it's an open admission by a member of a fellow of a U.S. Think tank organization close to the U.S. government that the U.S. government actually funds political activities by Saakashvili and his supporters in Ukraine.
Why not? They've been funding everyone else in Ukraine.
It all traces back to John McCain, if you ask me. I mean, don't you remember? It was all about we're all Georgian now. When it was back,
we're all Ukrainians now.
So I think the more you see McCain start to lose his mind and go a little crazy, the more who's the patron of Saakashvili, you see him also start to lose his mind and go a little crazy.
This is the real problem: is that the neocons in Washington and also in Europe now, because we're starting to see Carl Bildt, Ilves Tumes, their own breed of exceptionalists and neocons in Europe. They are grooming these proxies in the former countries of the Soviet Union and who are so unhinged. Part of the reason they're so unhinged is they're selected and groomed by these neocons and exceptionalists who are themselves so unhinged. And this is, and pushing towards confrontation with Russia. This is not going to stop. We're going to keep seeing figures like Mikhail Saakashvili, like Andrei Paruby, the neo-Nazi speaker of the Rada in the Ukraine.
Interesting here. I mean, I noticed that, Bloomberg, not the most friendly outlet towards Russia. They are openly questioning the idea of continuing to back somebody like Saakashvili. I mean, it's the wrong guy to back, meaning there could have been someone else there. But, Saakashvili was long the darling of the neocons.
Well, look, Saakashvili is not being groomed to be the president of Ukraine.
He actually,
the U.S. never considered him somebody who could become president of Ukraine. He's not Ukrainian. His psychological stance, sort of outlook, is somewhat different than the Ukrainians would expect. So he is being used as a pressure tool, as leverage against the current government of Ukraine, which is also controlled by the U.S., to make them do certain things that Washington wants.
This is how
the U.S. operates.
And that's putting pressure on Poroshenko.
Essentially, this is the way the United States government operates in its different colonial states. It uses different politicians, puts them against pits them against each other, and then uses that situation to get the policy that Washington wants from them.
Leonid Bershitsky's piece. He's right about one thing. The West controls who took power in Ukraine and who maintains it now.
And that's from Bloomberg. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. This is the end of our broadcast segments. Stay with us for the extended version on YouTube. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.